This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Okay, now do you believe the economy is in trouble? Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve got up early this morning, had a look around, and didn't much like what they saw. The central bank cut its main interest rate 0.75% this morning. That's the biggest whack it's taken in 25 years. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's a Tuesday today. Could have been a Black Tuesday, but it wasn't. The 22nd of January. Great to have you here. We started with them yesterday, and we will do it again today. Overseas stock exchanges, because they are the proximate cause of the Fed's rate cut. Today was shaping up to be another gruesome session in many of the world's big markets. The Shanghai Composite gave up more than 7% today on top of Monday's loss of 5%. Europe was tumbling, too, until the announcement by the Federal Open Market Committee at 8 this morning. Technically, it's called an intermeeting cut. There is a regularly scheduled meeting on the calendar for next week, when who knows, we might even see another cut as the Fed plays catch up with the economy. Marketplace's Bob Moon gets us started on the news of the day.
Last week's unemployment shock and growing credit market worries just added to the momentum of the bad news express, threatening to pull the stock market along with it on a steep downhill course. Today, you could almost picture Ben Bernanke and his crew running alongside as fast as they could to keep up. And even after the Fed sprinted into action, Wall Street investors kept on signaling it'll have to run even faster if it hopes to catch this runaway train.
It is very difficult to get out in front.
Nigel Gault is chief U.S. economist for Global Insight.
Fed rate cuts take time to have a positive effect on the economy. So the Fed is really looking forward to try to help us 6 to 12 months from now.
Not everyone agreed with the Fed action. Some economists voiced concerns it smacked of panic. But others argued with a recession looming and the stock market headed for a possible crash, the Fed had to do something. Doug Roberts is chief investment strategist for Channel Capital Research.
Once the spiral started, it would be much more difficult to control, would take even more medicine to do it.
Indeed, the Fed no longer seems concerned about appearances that it might somehow be bailing out stock market investors. University of Maryland economist Peter Morici.
The Fed doesn't want to see the stock price of General Electric or IBM or General Motors or even small companies fall because the banks have made bad decisions.
Morici expects yet another rate cut when the Fed meets next week, and he says it'll take more than that to restore confidence in U.S. financial markets.
Remember, the Fed has general oversight in the banking system. It can talk to the banks directly about their lending practices and demand changes in what they do.
Morici says the Fed needs to tell the banking industry to clean up its act once and for all. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Wall Street banks are going to get a bump from this rate cut in the long run. Stocks, too, probably. But most of that confidence Peter Morici was talking about comes from you and me, the American consumer. So, what's in today's cut for us? To find out, we've called Kevin Flanagan at Morgan Stanley. Mr. Flanagan, good to have you here.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So I'll tell you, my first thought this morning when I saw this news was, well, first of all, that we had our lead story. But second of all, I wondered if it was time for me to refinance my mortgage. I mean, there's going to be a consumer boon out of this, right?
Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah, actually, it's going to take some time. This isn't something I would rush out immediately. I think, obviously, credit affordability has improved. The problem right now are credit standards. Standards are extraordinarily tight, and it's going to take some time before we actually see that begin to relax, where I think some of this boon that you would expect from lower interest rates begins to take hold.
Care to offer me a number in terms of months or years?
I would say you're probably looking at least 6 months at a minimum.
Is this something that's going to affect my car loan and my credit cards and all those sorts of things?
Yeah, it should. You know, ultimately, that's the goal, sort of this ripple effect through other parts of consumer debt and to bring debt service payments down, perhaps in other areas. So that, of course, helps and does offset to some degree some of the higher food and energy prices that we've been seeing.
Let's look at the calendar then 6 months from now. We've got the Fed interest rates starting to kick in. We've got a stimulus package probably going to pass Congress in the next couple of months. The consumer, in theory, should be sitting pretty well with lower interest rates and some cash in their pockets.
Yeah, that's certainly the goal, I think, of what the Fed's trying to do. The one concern that we have here, especially from a bond side of the equation, is the Fed sort of abandoning inflation. You know, in our opinion, we're a little bit critical as to why the Fed felt that they had to go today rather than wait until next week when you have a formal policy session. So they are sending the markets in particular some messages with respect to where their concerns are, obviously focusing on global stocks and also sort of abandoning any concerns on the inflation front. So those are going to be forces that play out as well as we move into the second half of the year.
This was a huge cut, 0.75%. Why shouldn't the consumer just throw their hands up and say, oh, my goodness, if Ben Bernanke thinks it's this bad that he's got to cut rates 0.75%, we're all doomed?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And, you know, it's not just the magnitude, as I was alluding to. It's also the timing. The end of last week, it was pretty much thought, you know, we did hear Ben Bernanke speak in public, that he didn't give you any sense this was going to occur. What happened over the weekend, we saw a global stock market certainly take a hit. So, you know, you have to wonder what is the Fed sort of reasoning behind this move? And that's the concern, that sometimes these can be counterproductive and that it does create a sense of panic, not just in the markets, but perhaps amongst consumers. So I think what we need to do is continue to watch the stock market, perhaps as a gauge as to whether or not this was the right thing for the Fed to do.
Look out a year from now for me. Do you think they'll start taking back some of these rate cuts?
That is a risk going forward. You know, Bernanke, it's been tough to take them at their word, but, you know, here we will try to, has sort of insisted in a lot of public commentary that the Fed could be quick to reverse any unnecessary easings. So I think it is very, sort of safe to say, if I can use that phrase, that the Fed could very well begin to take some of these rate cuts back next calendar year in 2009.
Kevin Flanagan is a fixed income strategist at Morgan Stanley. Kevin, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks a lot.
Now, here's one way to look at the stock market today. It wasn't really a 130-point loss on the Dow. Investors actually came back 340 points from the opening lows after the Fed made its cut. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. World Economic Forum kicks off tomorrow in Davos, Switzerland. There will be lots of schmoozing and high-concept panel discussions over the ensuing couple of days, as well as some announcements timed to capitalize on all the publicity. A company called 23andMe will introduce a direct-to-consumer genetic testing service for Europeans. It's already available here in the United States. Send them $999 and a swab of your saliva. 6 weeks later, you get some pretty detailed analysis of your DNA. But might that be the very definition of too much information? From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
23andMe won't tell you how likely you are to develop certain diseases. The company's website says it'll help you read and understand your DNA.
The majority of people don't have any real background in genetics and how to even interpret that information.
Sarah Lieber directs the Human Genetics Program at Sarah Lawrence College. She says the problem with direct-to-consumer genetics tests is that the results may confuse consumers.
So that while the 23andMe site has something they call Genetics 101, the concepts are tough, and it takes a while for them to sink in and have people understand what they mean.
She says people should consult health professionals to fully understand the implications of their results. Stephen Kiles is president-elect of the National Society of Genetic Counselors. He says it's a good idea to consult a counselor before embarking on a home test.
If they were talking to a genetic counselor prior to testing, they would have a much better understanding and expectation, which would alleviate the stress that can be caused post-test.
David Mongiello of the American Clinical Laboratory Association likes the idea of home testing, but he says diagnosis should be done in federally approved labs. Right now, there's little federal oversight of this business, but Mongiello says too much might be on the way.
It would be an error to have duplicative and redundant regulatory oversight on these services that will really slow down and maybe even stifle the promise of this whole genetic personalized medicine,
which he says will be a positive force in the delivery of healthcare. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
The Democratic presidential candidates held their umpteenth debate last night, but there was no snoozing through this one. Obama, Clinton, and Edwards duked it out in South Carolina with more than the usual quotient of personal and policy attacks. One of the big issues was health care in this country. Each of the candidates has a plan to fix it. Today, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Massachusetts made its offering by rolling out a plan to change the way hospitals and doctors get paid. Instead of Blue Cross paying for every hospital visit and every surgery, the insurance giant is offering to pay a flat annual fee per patient. Stacey Vanek-Smith takes a look.
Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts will pay hospitals and doctors an annual flat rate for every patient, adjusted to reflect health and age. But there would be big bonuses when care achieved positive results.
So it's really a change in the whole way we think about financing healthcare in this nation.
Massachusetts Blue Cross Vice President Andrew Dreyfus says 5% of his company's members generate half of all costs. That's because they have chronic conditions like heart disease, so they need long-term care. Dreyfus says under the new plan, bonuses would be doled out if certain benchmarks were met. Say the patient's cholesterol stayed in check after surgery, so the hospital would be encouraged to follow up with the patient.
Every time there's a visit, every time there's a surgery, we pay for the volume of care or the complexity of care. We don't pay for the outcome of the care. And what we're trying to do is flip the payment system really on its head. And instead of just paying for more, we want to pay for better.
Dreyfus says it's a whole lot cheaper than paying for another surgery. Merrill Guzner is with the Center for Science in the Public Interest. He says he wishes it were that easy.
What I would hate to see is a repeat of what happened in the 1990s.
Guzner says there's a risk with plans like these, similar to what happened to the well-intentioned HMO.
The fear is that these sort of flat payments could be a way for hospitals or doctors to deny care because it will cost them more money than what the flat payment might be.
Guzner says the strategy could work if it were properly regulated. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
The Wall Street Journal floated an interesting little item today. The paper says eBay CEO Meg Whitman is getting set to step down. A spokesman declined to comment on that, but the news does raise the question of succession at one of Silicon Valley's last remaining pre-dot-com boom companies. So how do you learn to lead in the world of high-stakes corporate affairs? Author Warren Bennis says it all comes down to one thing, judgment, which, as it happens, is the title of his new book. Professor Bennis, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
I'm going to start at the end and do a little counterintuitive thing here. And I'm going to go to the very last line of the book, and I'm going to read it to you, and I'm going to ask you a question off of that. It says, we need more leaders with better judgment. That sort of, to me, implies that judgment is a thing that can be taught.
Well, no. It can be caught, but I doubt that it can be taught. But I think if you can put people into a learning situation over time with experience – and with getting lots of valid feedback and lots of practice, I think one can learn something about judgment, especially by making bad ones.
But, you know, it's one thing for a junior executive of 28, 30 years old to have one of those moments that are unfortunate in their result but are a teachable moment, mm-hmm. right? It's one thing for that person to have it. It's another thing for a 60-year-old person running a $500 million a year company to have mm-hmm. one of those moments. I mean, the consequences are freighted there.
Mm-hmm. You hope that when you get to running a half-billion-dollar company, you've had enough previous experience. Let me be very concrete about this now.
Go ahead.
Let's take Carly Fiorina, a well-known head of Hewlett-Packard. And she was the first woman to be CEO and chairman of Hewlett-Packard. She was the first non-engineer. And more importantly, she was the first non-Hewlett-Packard exec get that job. In our book, We talked about four kinds of intelligence. And to me, one of the key ones is what we call contextual intelligence. If you want to lead people, you got to enter their world. And Carly never quite got the HP engineering, pretty much all male culture. What I mean is she was seduced a bit by being the first, being the first this, being the first that. And she was on the cover of every magazine. She went to all the important big conference, to the Davos, the World Economic Forum, but she didn't spend enough time at home getting the contextual understanding of the culture of HP. And I think in retrospect, she regrets that.
One of the euphemisms you guys use in this book for judgment is making the right call, which sort of implies that it's an instantaneous thing. You make the call and then you go on about your business. But really, you need to do some in-flight mid-course corrections, don't you?
Mm-hmm, you do. I'm glad you brought that up because we refer to it in the book as redoing, as redos. And I think one of the
do-overs in playground lingo, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. And you know, there was a true story of when Andy Grove got the idea that Intel ought to get out of the memory business and into the microprocessor business. And that epiphany, he knocked on the door of Gordon Moore, who was then the chairman, and said, if somebody took us over tomorrow, what would be the first thing they would do? And Gordon stopped for a moment, and Andy said, they'd get out of the memory business and into the microprocessor business. And Gordon Moore said, you know, Andy, that's exactly right. So why don't we do that?
Now, what do you think that judgment call was based on?
Based on tons of experience, reflection, and lots of practice. If you look at any master, and I think Andy Grove is a master at being a leader, but you look at whether it's Yo-Yo Ma, whether it's Tiger Woods, whether you look at a master of any trade, any business, how do they become masters? Practice and reflection.
Warren Bennis has been teaching at USC, the University of Southern California, for a number of years. His latest book with Noel Tishy is called Judgment. Professor Bennis, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, cyberspace faces tough economic realities.
Second Life is a world in which you can fly just as easily as you can walk. Maybe the idea of building a store doesn't make much sense.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street took a 464-point nosedive this morning before regaining some altitude. The Dow met the bell at 128 points, down 1% to finish at 11,971. The Nasdaq dropped 47 points, 2% to end at 2,292. The S&P 500 sank 14 points, 1.1% to close at 1,310. The rocky ride dented some bellwethers. Procter & Gamble lost 3%. So did ExxonMobil as oil prices eased. Investors bit off more than 3% from Microsoft, Cisco Systems and Apple. The Fed action to slash that key interest rate today lifted bank stocks. Bank of America and Wachovia skipped up nearly 4%. Lehman Brothers rose more than 3%. Morgan Stanley and Bear Stearns laughed their way to the bank today with a 7.5% gain apiece. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces.
It's at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming talks about the role of auctioning tradable pollution allowances under a climate cap-and-trade system. In Davos, leaders from around the globe focus on the power of collaborative innovation at this year's World Economic Forum. And it's National Handwriting Day, an opportunity to take up a pen instead of type on a keyboard. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
First in our letters segment this week, some office politics. Not our office, though. The offices of the clothing maker American Apparel. We told you yesterday company founder Dove Charney is facing a sexual harassment case. Among other things, he's accused of attending meetings in his underwear. And we quoted a retail consultant who had this to say.
When you go work at a company, you have to fit with their culture. The culture doesn't fit with you.
That attitude didn't sit well with listener Carla Simmons of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Gives people a license, if you're running a company, to do anything you want, including sexual harassment. And I don't think anybody, man or a woman, working for a company needs to put up with that.
From an American office to an Iraqi one now, a couple of weeks ago, we reported on a team of soldiers in Iraq whose job it is to tally up the damages. They then pay Iraqis for property and lives lost in the course of coalition battles and searches. Nina Robertson of Stanford, California, wrote to tell us the skeptical take on Iraqis disturbed her a bit.
The general takeaway message was that the vast majority of the people asking for compensation were being dishonest, and that therefore maybe there was some sort of overcompensation of Iraqis going on, where I don't think we're compensating them enough for their hardship.
Fred Thompson dropped out of the Republican presidential race today. He never really did seem to catch on. Some say he only stayed in through South Carolina to help out his friend John McCain by taking votes from Mike Huckabee. We aired a commentary about the former Arkansas governor's tax plan a week or so ago. It's being called the Fair Tax. Some of you, Warren Stiles of Sammamish, Washington, for instance, wrote to say that our commentary was anything but fair.
His commentary completely ignored the point that by eliminating income tax, a vast swath of income currently diverted to government coffers will remain in the pockets of taxpaying companies and hardworking Americans.
Clearly, Marketplace listeners like to write to us about taxes. There were a couple of dozen letters about that commentary. But you love to write about television. We asked you last week if the screenwriter strike is affecting your viewing habits. It sure is mine. And we got a flood of responses. Some of you welcome the game shows and gladiators who've taken over your TVs. But more of you seem to have just tuned out, like Renee Riley of Meridian, Idaho.
We'd already become bored with and cut out many of the shows we'd been desperate to watch and had seriously examined the anatomy of our viewing habits.
If you're looking for a way to fill your empty evenings until the writers go back to work, write to us. Our website is marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on the link that says contact. Try though you might, it is tough to escape a slowing economy. There's even a downturn in the virtual world. As of today, banks in Second Life are going to be strictly regulated. Linden Lab, the very real company that created Second Life, is stepping in after some big virtual bank defaults. But maybe you've been too busy with your first life to have even heard about a second one. It's a place where real people craft computer versions of themselves, and they make stuff and buy stuff and sell stuff and trade stuff, or they just hang out there. Second Life was supposed to be the next great internet space, but the virtual universe has been shrinking. Janet Babin reports now from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
I'm shocked by how many of my real-life friends have never visited Second Life. So before I tell you who's leaving this space, I'm going to give you the 50-cent tour. Lisa will be our guide. She really knows how to click her way around the metaverse. She runs an art gallery there. We head in through her laptop. The scenery on the login page looks cartoony and pretty empty. Second Life residents, not its owner Linden Lab, create most of the things you see in World.
Online right now, there's 53,872 people worldwide
But all we see is Lisa's avatar, Jade Diva Ophelia. Barbie body, tight blue jeans. Let's just say Jade Diva is a bit of a departure from Lisa's real self.
Jade Diva is much more popular than I ever was. Much more flirtatious, much more creative in what she's willing to wear.
That's part of the appeal of Second Life. Your alter ego can dare to be whoever you want to be. There are troglodytes, butterflies, even some naked avatars complete with eye-popping attachments. Second Life's endless possibilities attracted broad media attention back in 2006. It was suddenly the virtual frontier, the wild, wild west. The online population grew to 10 million. Companies soon followed. They wanted their brands in front of these early adopters. Toyota and Apple, among others, created stores to sell virtual products. But for some, the payoff hasn't materialized. In November, active user hours in Second Life were down 5% for only the second time in history. Brian Haven with Forrester Research says avatars and marketers are checking out.
I just logged in a few days ago. I usually go and visit all these different brand sites, and most of them are either closed up or if they're still open, it's a ghost town. It's a little creepy wandering around in the virtual space, and there's just nobody else there.
Trendy clothing company American Apparel led the in-world exodus last spring. Starwood Hotels, AOL, and Wells Fargo followed.
We didn't really see a tremendous ongoing value.
That's Raz Shunning. He's American Apparel's web director. He says the store in Second Life didn't generate enough revenue. Too many seven-foot-tall winged creatures flying around, with no need for American Apparel's cotton T-shirts.
Second Life is a world in which you can fly just as easily as you can walk. Maybe the idea of building a store doesn't make much sense.
Setting up shop in World is relatively cheap. $1,700 to get started, $300 a month rent for a parcel that's about 2.5 acres. But companies often have to spend millions in technology assistance to effectively market themselves. Marketing expert Mark Hughes says it's not usually worth the trouble.
The people in Second Life, they aren't worth reaching. It's just a weird place. It's never going to catch on. It's a fad, not a fashion at all.
Yankee Group Research found that less than 2% of people it surveyed had ever even been in a virtual world. Compare that with 32% who'd visited online video sharing sites like YouTube. Christopher Collins with Yankee Group says the problem with Second Life is it's a tethered experience.
You need to be sitting at your computer to use it. Our research shows that mainstream audiences increasingly want to be able to access all of their information through mobile devices.
But Second Life has been listening to its critics since it came online in 2003. Glenn Fisher with Linden Lab says the virtual world is where the web was in the early 90s. He says back then,
a lot of people would come up to you and say, so what's this web thing? I don't get it. Why should I spend any time here? It's all websites created by a bunch of people who have way too much time on their hands.
And we all know how that story turned out. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
These final notes today of the good news, bad news variety. The bad news is especially bad for advisors to Republican presidential candidates down in Florida. Rudy Giuliani's top people have been working without pay for a while now. Today, Mike Huckabee's camp said some of his top staffers are foregoing their salaries, too. The good news is that plane tickets out of Florida won't be as pricey as expected. We had closed on Friday with the news that major carriers had doubled their fuel surcharges. They all pulled them back today on worries about the slowing economy. Speaking of which, oil was off 79 cents today to just under $90 a barrel. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow lopped off 128 points, 1%. The Nasdaq fell 47 points, 2%. The S&P 500 dropped 14 points. That is 1.1%, but it could have been oh so much worse. Thanks to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, hair-raising tales of Shanghai commutes.
When I first got to China, I didn't know how to merge into traffic. And I finally realized it was like, you know, Ray Charles behind the wheel. you can't look, and you just hit the gas and go.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.